Good morning. So, last time we finished our major topics in scheduling. We'll have a little bit of extra scheduling topics that are more minor today. Talked about shortest job first and shortest remaining time first. And this was how we optimized for response time. Remember that with first come, first served, gave this advantage to the first task. And we learned that giving that advantage is precisely how we optimize response time if the advantage goes to things which are short, because then the other things don't have to wait very much for those to finish. And as far as average response time, that means the average is lower because everything is waiting less. So shortest job first was what we did without preemption. We just said, what's the runtime of this? We run the shortest thing first. Gets a little more complicated when we have preemption, because what if something becomes ready while we're running something else? We need to make a decision as to whether it's worth stopping that other thing. And the way we did that is shortest remaining time first. We don't just take into account how long it takes. We need to know how much is left. We compare which one has less left, and that's what gets to run first. That's what minimizes how much everyone waits on average. We talked about multi-level feedback queue scheduling, where the idea here is that we had different priority levels, and our priority level determined our quantum length. So not only do we want to have short things, things which had these short CPU bursts have high priority, we enforce that by making the higher priorities have shorter time quanta. And we adjusted what priority processes were at based on whether they used that whole time quantum or not. If they used the whole thing, we know probably they should be lower. So we move it down in priority. If they use less, we move it up in priority the next time it becomes runnable, because if you use less immediately afterwards, it's not in any run queue, it's waiting for something. But the next time we remember that, oh, you didn't use your whole thing, so next time we should start you higher. And we mentioned that this strategy is prone to starvation, that if some task is sitting in the bottom priority, if there's enough stuff on the system, it'll never get to run. So that's a common consideration when you implement this for real. It's not only are we sort of guessing on where to put things in the right priority, you might have some additional sort of guesswork to say, oh, this thing has been waiting too long, we probably should run it to keep the user from getting angry, and just in case, maybe it really does run for a real short amount of time, and we just don't have any way of knowing yet. We also mentioned that multi-level feedback scheduling was prone to gaming. That if you just made sure that you used the CPU for a little amount of time and then you waited, but not very long, then this you use less than quantum move up in priority heuristic works and you win. So if you can have some fake sort of sleep to do, you can game this system. You could imagine countermeasures for that, but it's an annoyance with this kind of scheduler. But it makes sense because we're trying to prioritize a particular type of program. So if you run that type of program, you artificially make your program that type of program, of course you get an advantage. We finished up by talking about proportional share scheduling, where the idea was that if you had twice the share, you got twice the CPU time, and we could assign shares to programs based on how important they were. And instead of with priority scheduling, if you're twice as important, you get all the CPU time. With proportional share scheduling, if you're twice as important, you get twice. Sort of what some people's notion of what twice as important means. And one way of implementing this, which you're going to do for the next homework, is lottery scheduling, which is basically we make a weighted random twice every time we have a scheduling decision. We just choose a random number, use that to choose a process in a way which deals with these shares that they're assigned, which in lottery scheduling we call tickets. Tickets for a lottery, we pull one lucky winner every time we need to make a scheduling decision. And like with priority scheduling, which we use to approximate shortest remaining time first, we can use lottery scheduling to approximate all sorts of schedules by just setting these shares appropriately. You know, if you just make the number of tickets, you know, differ by like a factor of 1,000, you're approximating priority scheduling because the poor process with one ticket basically never runs as long as the process with 1,000 tickets is in the system. So just to preview the lottery scheduling assignment, there are basically four parts. So you need to track the number of ticks a process runs. In a real system, we'd like look at a clock and account for what if the process doesn't use its whole time slice. For this assignment, keep things simple. We just want you to count the number of times it gets scheduled. So don't worry about whether it used a whole time slice or not. So you just, every time the scheduler makes a scheduling decision, you increment a counter that probably you need to add to a process struct. We need a new system call, get processes info, which will be spelled correctly in the assignment, to copy info from the process table into user space, which we need so we can actually figure out if you're doing the right thing. We need to read those tick counters, and I'd rather not like write code to look into the kernel structures. So I want a user space API for that. And you need to write that. That system call, which is going to be a little more complicated than the one you've done before, because instead of just returning an integer, you're returning in a big array of things, which means you need to copy into a pointer that's going to be passed in. And a new system call to set tickets. Since we're implementing a lottery scheduler, you need to set the number of tickets. So the assignment tells you a default. It should be inherited on fork, which you actually need to write code for. It's not free. And there's a system call to set the current process's number of tickets. And your scheduler, which you need to implement, is you choose a pseudorandom number to choose which process weighted by the tickets. We don't care if it's actually random. You can use pseudorandom with a fixed C, that's fine. I would note that you cannot use floating point. XV6 doesn't have floating point support. You could conceptually add it. It's probably not actually that much code, but probably not worth it. So just as a note, if you try to use float, you'll get an exception for FPU not present because XV6 does not set up the floating point registers to exist. Like, you have to actually flip a bit in a special register to do that. And the reason for that is that XV6 also doesn't save the floating point registers anytime. Doesn't have the code. You remember when we saw context switches, we didn't see any floating point registers in there. Doesn't handle that. So questions about the assignment or about everything we did last time? Yes?
When you say that the number of tickets should be inherited on fork, you mean like it's copied to the child process?
When I say it's inherited on fork, I mean it's copied to the child process? Yes, exactly. Yes.
What if you have enough processes that collectively there are tickets add up to more than int max?
So the question is, what do you do if tickets add up to more than int max? We will construct things so we will guarantee that the total number of tickets is well less than 2 to the 32, probably well less than like 100 million. So you shouldn't have rounding issues. I would note you also will have trouble using long 64-bit integers in the XV6 kernel. Because there's some code that GCC uses, like GCC has a function to do the divides that's not in the XV6 kernel that it calls when you divide two 64-bit numbers on a 32-bit system. Because you can't just, there's no 64-bit divide instruction in 32-bit x86. So it should, yeah, we'll set the ticket counts so you shouldn't have any problems using 32-bit integers. Other questions? So, I'd like to talk about one problem with lottery scheduler. Talked about another last time. So let's say I have two processes, and I give them the same number of tickets. So each of them has one ticket for a lottery, And A is CPU bound, B is IO bound, not IO bound, but like that's a lot of IO. So it's off like, so it's reading from the keyboard, so it's often waiting for keyboard input. And what a lottery scheduler will do is when both can run, it will run them equally. And the result of this is going to be that B gets to run less than A. Because when they're both runnable, it runs half the time. When only A is runnable, of course it doesn't run. So that result is it runs significantly less than half the time. So you might say that this is unfair, it depends who you ask. In some sense it's fair, because when they're both runnable, they're both getting their fair share, but over the long term they aren't. And one idea, one thing that people have proposed is that you just, when you notice that B's waiting, you just give it a few extra tickets for a while and then take them away. There's ways of like using the same scheduling algorithm to solve this. We're gonna look at a different solution. In fact, a different solution that is what Linux does to implement proportional share scheduling that deals with this problem. There was also the other problem we talked about, which is variance, that over the long term, we do get these nice consistencies because the random choices work out. If you keep rolling dice, you know, you're gonna get pretty close to the right distribution, but over the short term, you might get lucky or unlucky. And that's not necessarily what we want. We often want something kind of more like weighted round robin, that everyone, you know, goes one then the other, and it pretty much just alternates, so you don't have to worry about someone managed to run two times in a row sometimes and not other times. We have that, you know, these short periods where it's a little, where we aren't getting the shares we expect. So Linux implements a scheduler which does something about each of these problems. So it's a deterministic proportional share scheduler. So it doesn't make random choices. And it has a very different solution to the interactivity problem than just compensating with extra tickets. So it's no randomization. It does some other nice things. So one thing is that its scheduling decision is big O of log N, which is not what your lottery scheduler will probably be linear time. A good lottery scheduler would be about big O of log N. That's a lot of extra work because you need to maintain some sort of data structure where you can make a weighted random choice in log time and also update it as processes become runnable. It's doable, it's not trivial. It favors interactive programs. And it also does something about time slices. So when we talk about lottery schedulers, we just ignore the time slice problem. But that's actually a concern, that you want to make sure, you want to adjust the time slice because you want to sort of balance between having everything, you know, be context switching all the time versus having to wait a long time for something to get to run. And Linux explicitly does something about that with its default scheduler. I know I say default scheduler, Linux has other schedulers. Linux has had like four default schedulers over the past decade, five, six, a lot. There's been a lot of changes to Linux's scheduler. Most of it, the changes have been improvements, mostly because the Linux like 2.0 scheduler was really bad. Like, just a lot of guesses that sometimes worked out. And also, I think it was linear time. So, the way Linux scheduler works, and this is called CFS for completely fair scheduler. So, it made a firm notion of what they think is fair, is that each thread, we track this notion of a virtual runtime, which is something like how long has the thread run for. It's not, I call it virtual runtime and they call it virtual runtime because it doesn't necessarily match like the actual like stopwatch time the thread's been running. But it's some useful approximation of that. And the idea is every time we need to schedule a thread, we're gonna choose the thread with the lowest virtual runtime. And to make this log n, we keep the threads in a balanced tree sorted by their virtual runtime. So we just look up the lowest item in the tree, and when we want to update virtual runtimes, it's a tree key update. You vaguely remember from 2150, so this is all log n. And every time something runs, we count the time from when it started running to when it finished, and we increment that virtual runtime. And we might make some adjustments. So we need, when we have a proportional share, the more important threads, we increment the runtime by multiplied by a factor. You might say, what makes something more or less important on Linux? So who here has ever seen the nice command? There's a command called nice or re-nice? No. So Linux and POSIX in general has sort of something called nice levels, which are controlled by the set priority library call. And you might think, set priority, well, that sets the priority, so things with higher priority always run before things with lower priority. That's not true. But things with higher priority, by this notion, these higher nice levels are more important, and the way Linux manifests that is by giving them more share. So you can set with this nice command or this set priority system call, you can set how much share something has in a rather indirect way. You aren't actually setting the share, you're setting some number which gets translated to a share by some magic formula that they made up to kind of do something useful maybe. But they have that there is this notion of nice levels for each thread, which determines like when, if they run for a second, does that count as running for two or half for the terms of who gets to run next? So if you have a factor of two, then you run half as often as someone with a factor of one. That's the idea. The other issue is, what do we do about threads which are new or were sleeping? We have to do some sort of adjustment there. We'll talk about in a bit. You don't just want to have their virtual runtime start at zero, because like my web browser's been running for, you know, 7 days, and then I start a new program, it shouldn't get to run for 7 days before my web browser runs again. So you want to make some sort of adjustment to make that fairer. But in, you know, not so extreme. You know, that's fair in a sense, like, oh, my web browser is 7 days ahead, we should let them catch up, but probably not 7 days catch up. So let's look at what the operation of this looks like. So here we say we have some programs that are always ready, we have a 1 millisecond quantum. So we'll look at our virtual runtimes, and we'll say that they're all evenly weighted. So A runs for a millisecond, we increment its virtual runtime by one, and now we say, oh, B has the lowest virtual runtime it gets to run, then C has the lowest virtual runtime it gets to run, then A does, and with equal shares, and everyone using the full quantum, this is exactly round robin. And if we change something, like we said that we multiplied its runtime by half to make it more important, then we run A twice as often. But otherwise, this is exactly round robin if everyone's using their whole time slice. So, makes sense. So I mentioned that we have to do something about new threads, or threads that are new in the sense that, you know, maybe they've been waiting for me to press a key for, you know, 10 seconds. And we're talking about milliseconds. A 10-second advantage would also be pretty bad. So what Linux does is it says that when a task becomes ready, its new virtual time is either its prior virtual time or a little less than the minimum virtual time of everything that's already ready. So basically, we give it a little bit of an advantage over the things which are already running, or we, I think a little less might potentially be none less if there's at some point. Like there's some tracker of like the current virtual time that's used to compute this. So I'm being approximate here because I'm not describing the exact rule for what a little less means. But basically, we give it a little bit of advantage over things which are currently running because it just became ready. If that helps it, but we don't actually make it, you know, get credit for that full 10 seconds it was waiting, because that would destroy our, you know, interactivity. You know, if you don't want all the other programs not to have their chance to run. And obviously you can tune what you mean by a little less to adjust this balance between how much do we benefit programs which are doing I/O, doing the shortest response time first thing, basically, versus how much do we benefit, you know, not benefit our overall sort of fairness in the very short term. And yeah, so the intuition is that if you're not runnable for a brief amount of time, you get your share of CPU. Like, that's the big idea, that if you're only sleeping for small amounts of time, you still get your fair share. We don't have that situation I talked about earlier where that program B still didn't get anything close to its fair share because it was runnable less often than A. So as long as you're sleeping for a short enough amount of time, you're doing little teeny bits of I/O, like reading from a disk, and that takes a couple milliseconds, you'll get exactly your fair share. If you're doing it for longer, you get some advantage because you're for running quickly. So even though you don't get as much CPU in aggregate, so you at least, you know, have the interactive programs get run quickly, which is what we want. When we press a key, I want that to be responded to fast, give us low response times. And so we can see how this works here. So let's say I have A. A doesn't use its whole time. So A runs for half a millisecond. So we record its virtual time. And then B runs, and let's say A became ready while B was running. Then now that A is ready, A definitely is going to have the lowest virtual time. And then now C is runnable, and A gets to run earlier than it would in round robin because it still has a lower virtual time than B. The way this worked out. Yes?
So basically, this is just picking the lowest virtual time.
Yeah, so this is basically picking the lowest virtual time? Yes, that is exactly our scheduling decision. So it's just a generalization of round robin in that sense. So this is the case where we keep the virtual time, where we decided that's not too much of an advantage. And it makes sense because A was only doing stuff for a millisecond. So we probably want to give it credit and still have it use its full share of CPU in the long term. But let's say A was asleep for a while. So A ran for 1.5 milliseconds of time, and now it's sleeping, and B and C are trading places. And B is running, and A becomes runnable. We don't want to actually set A's virtual time to be still 1.5, because then A will run for the next 50 milliseconds, basically. So we set it a little behind what's already there. In this case, I've just arbitrarily chosen that it's going to be a millisecond behind B because it just became runnable. So it gets to run for an extra millisecond as credit for the 50 milliseconds it was sleeping. Yeah? Question is, when two processes have the same virtual runtime, how do you choose which one? I don't know what Linux does. I would guess they just choose whatever is leftmost in the balance tree they're using, which is a red-black tree. And then we keep going. Let's say A goes back to sleep in this case. Yeah.
Do the
numbers ever reset?
Can the numbers ever reset? I don't think so. I think they use big enough things that they generally don't worry about wraparound, but I'm not sure how they deal with that. I think they may have some way of dealing with wraparound. As usual, like, the primary documentation is probably the code, and the secondary documentation is that someone at some Linux conference for Linux developers made a presentation about it, and there were a write-up that's on probably Linux Journal. This stuff is not very much done in academia. I guess there's an academic write-up where people have looked at it. There's a paper on how the completely fair scheduler dealt with multi-threading, which sort of accidentally describes how it works, because you have to do that to talk about what you're analyzing to do that. And I mentioned proportional sharing. So with proportional sharing, we just change how we increment the virtual time, like to multiply by something. Make it. So the other issue I talked about was quantum lengths. So here I've been showing that we just give things a millisecond quantum, and maybe they don't use the whole thing. The Linux completely fair scheduler tries to set the quantum more intelligently with the idea that the quantum should change based on how much we have runnable. Then if we have a lot of things to run, we should use sorter quantum so we get to all of them frequently, so none of them has to wait for a very long time, so we have a lower response time. And if we have few things to run, we want to context switch less often, so we should have a longer quantum. So there are these two priorities. So one is that they constrain the minimum quantum length. So this is a configurable setting, but by default they say, we're going to run everything for at least 0.75 milliseconds. I just made an arbitrary choice that less than that would be too much context switch overhead. And by at least that much time, I mean it's 0.75 milliseconds or until it gives up the CPU. So obviously if anything gives up the CPU, we don't waste the rest of its time quantum, we just run the next thing. And the second priority is that they want to run every runnable program at least a certain amount of time, and their target is 6 milliseconds. And that's a second priority, so if you have too many programs to do that with 0.75 millisecond quantums, it just takes longer for every program to get to run. So they just say, we're going to divide up that 6 millisecond window by the number of processes, except if that would make our time quantum less than the minimum, in which case we use the minimum. And an observation here is on a typical like desktop system, the number of runnable programs per core is pretty low. So, like, probably we usually have a quantum which is bigger than the minimum. So there's another thing they do with quantums, which is what do we do when a program becomes runnable? And I sort of glossed over that issue of, like, so a program becomes runnable, I tell you how we set its initial virtual time, but there's a question of, well, if it has a lower virtual time, when do we run it? Do we wait for the current thing to finish, like round robin, or do we just start it right away? And we'd like to start it right away, because that's going to give us better response time. But we don't want to do that all the time, because if a lot of things finish, like reading from a disk at the same time, we might do context switching very rapidly. And we want to limit the context switch overhead in general. So our solution for that is that we schedule newly runnable tasks, try to schedule newly runnable tasks immediately, but only if it has enough of an advantage in this virtual time over what's currently running. And the idea here is that we assume that otherwise we're context switching too often, but if it's important enough, if it's enough ahead, it has enough credit for its CPU time, we should start it earlier. Even if that, lowers our throughput. So there's other few things about CFS I'm not going to talk about. One of the important issues is I haven't talked about how we deal with multiple cores. And this is actually a very nasty topic with solutions in pretty much every scheduler I've seen that aren't extremely elegant. I'll talk about that problem separately in a bit. Another thing is CFS tries to do some work, the completely fair scheduler, to deal with groups of related tasks. Like if I have two programs which are talking to each other by a pipe, we want to schedule them differently. It tries to take advantage of that. It also has some special settings which are dealt with in a way other than virtual time for idle or batch tasks, for things that we want to run whenever there's spare CPU and which we want to run, we just want to use all the CPU they can, but they don't particularly care when they get it. And so these are sort of basically lower priority than everything which has virtual time tracking. And also, these are things that we ideally want to run with very long time slices, because we know they're probably going to use as much CPU as they can get. So the completely fair scheduler is not a new idea. So this basic idea of having this notion of virtual time and scheduling the thing with lowest virtual time was proposed in academia in 95 by the same people who wrote the lottery scheduler idea down as stride scheduling. And it's very similar to that. And this idea is in turn very similar to scheduling from a completely different domain, not CPUs, but scheduling network traffic. Scheduling how we send packets on the internet. There's something called weighted fair queuing, which was originally published in 89, and it's basically exactly the same algorithm. So questions on the completely fair scheduler? So I'm going to have a note on multiprocessors. Just to mention that these are a problem. We probably won't go into this, though maybe if you're really interested in the semester, we can talk about how you write a multiprocessor scheduler. But there's these extra considerations which make schedulers hard. Just to let you know what they are, I'm not going to go over solutions. As I said, I don't know of really elegant solutions for these. So one thing is that we want, when we have two cores or two processors, we want them to be able to schedule without waiting for each other. You don't want processors waiting to figure out what to run. That's really wasted work. And we really don't want to do that if we have like 64 cores. You don't want everyone to only be able to schedule one at a time. We also want to keep processors on the same processor because we want them to have things in the cache that's on that processor. We want them to keep running there. And this conflicts with all our other scheduling goals. So like, I want to run this high priority thing soon, but I was running it on a core which is running another high priority thing. Do I move it and lose that cache advantage? That's a hard decision. It's a hard trade-off to make, and the solutions aren't great. Another thing is like, let's say I have a higher priority thing, I need to run it somewhere, which thing of everything that's running, if I have four cores, there's three, like maybe three of them are things I could preempt, which one do I do? That's a tricky decision. Okay, so that's considerations, and there are attempts to deal with it, none of which I think are excellent. So all the scheduling algorithms we looked at so far are what we might call best effort scheduling. Basically, we take the state of the system, we try to do the best possible thing, and that's fine. And we're happy with that. There's an alternate model where we really actually need guarantees. So like, I'm processing audio, and I'm trying to like do some effects, and I want this to have 1 millisecond delay so you hear it in real time as I'm speaking, you hear this distorted audio and like my performance. Or I have a computer controlled cutting machine where I'm sending a command through a wire to stop the cutting and I want to do it at a precise time so I get the right shape. Or I have the computer in my car, which controls the brake and engine, and I'd like it to send the signals to the brake and engine at the appropriate time so they act correctly. These are all cases where we want things to run at a precise time. And we have like a real deadline that we need to meet or things go wrong. And this best effort notion isn't acceptable, especially in something like the car scenario. We're not gonna say, yeah, the scheduler will usually send the signal to stop accelerating on time. You know, we'll usually run that process, but no, that doesn't always work out that way. We want to say, yeah, it's always gonna happen. And so a notion for this is, you know, that we get some event that's gonna need some processing, and it needs to be finished by some deadline. That processing might be figure out what signal to send out on some control for the engine or the cutter or whatever. And the idea is that we have these chunks of CPU we need to run before each of the deadlines. And naive algorithms often won't do this. So if we do round robin here, we end up missing the deadline. This makes sense. So we miss one of the deadlines, we make the other two. Yes?
How do I read this?
So how do we read this? That the yellow task becomes ready here, it starts running, the blue task becomes ready, and we alternate with round robin, the green task became ready here, and we alternate to it, and green's deadline was here, and we missed it, blue's deadline was here, we made it, yellow's deadline was here, we made it. And became ready is probably like we received an input that we had to respond to. Or a timer went off. So the scheduling algorithm we solved this is, well, we want to run the things that have the earliest deadline first, just like how you probably figure out what homework to do first. So if we do that, we get a solution which actually schedules this. Yeah?
When do we start knowing about the deadline for each process?
The question is, when do we know about the deadline? So in these systems, hopefully, we know about the deadlines as soon as whenever we're running a program, we know what its deadline is. And ideally, we know about this when we're building the system. And I'll mention this problem later, because if we can't meet all the deadlines, and sometimes it's not possible to meet all the deadlines, if I squeeze the deadlines in, then earliest deadline first won't meet all the deadlines because there's no way to do it. You have to sacrifice a deadline. And if we can't meet all the deadlines, what we want to say is, hey, you can't use this computer to control your car. That's what we want to say. You can't do it. We want to tell them that when you're building it or when you're trying to run like your audio processing, you want to say, sorry, I can't do your audio effects. We're going to say no. And so this is something you might call admission control, that we want to not admit things to the system if we can't do them. So earliest deadline first, we'll meet all the deadlines if we can, but if we can't, we want to figure out that we can't do this based on what we know the start times are, like when we receive this input, we need to respond in 5 milliseconds. That's the sort of things that we're going to know. We want to figure out what's the worst possible case. We want to say, can we meet the deadlines given our scheduling algorithm? Which usually would ideally be earliest deadline first. Sometimes that's too complicated for like an embedded system, and they'll use something like priority with static priority assignments, where hopefully they've set the priorities so things with shorter deadline periods are higher priority, for example. But whatever the algorithm is, you figure out what could possibly happen, what inputs could I get, how long do I have to respond to them, and you say, can I make guarantee that I'm going to never run into this situation? And if you can't, you want to say no. You want to say, sorry, you know, I can't, this program won't work for this car, you need to get a different CPU to handle it. You want to say no, something like that. So something to know about earliest deadline first is earliest deadline first, it's the best way of meeting deadlines. And it's really good at meeting deadlines. It doesn't do all our other heuristics. It's really it, all our other sort of measures. It doesn't optimize them because it's doing something else. So it doesn't minimize response time because that's not the same, because deadlines, responding to deadlines on time is not the same thing as responding to inputs quickly. Especially like if some inputs have longer deadlines. It doesn't maximize throughput because it might context switch more than we need, more than, you know, we strictly need to. And it doesn't try to do fairness because it's trying to prioritize things which we need to solve quicker deliberately. We can, you know, so you can should see ways that can happen. So questions about real-time scheduling. And so I know, because this is like a different type of scheduler, if you need to do something like this, you probably aren't using an OS with the, at least you aren't using, either using a special OS or using an OS with a non-default scheduler, because you don't get this for, you don't get these guarantees for free. So that's everything about scheduling. So what scheduler do you use? So if you care about CPU throughput, first come, first serve. Just minimize context switches, make the scheduling as simple as possible to save time. First come, first serve does that. If you care about average response time across programs, you do something like SRTF, shortest remaining time first. If you care about I/O throughput, if you want to utilize like the disk, you do shortest remaining time first because that will minimize the average time until a program starts running and does its I/O, which is going to let the I/O device have as much work as possible. If you care about fairness in the long term, you do something like CFS, like the completely fair scheduler in Linux. You care about fairness in the short term, like for wait time, for how long you're waiting, round robin does that. Just switching gives you equal time waiting. If you care about deadlines, you do earliest deadline first. If you have particular people who are important, you do priority. So, questions about scheduling. Hopefully this is useful summary, maybe. Okay, so our next topic is going to be threads for real. And we saw the notion that we can have multi-threaded processes. Processes where we have multiple stacks, registers, and the idea is that we have multiple cores. Each of these threads can have the registers on one core, on another, and can actually be running at the same time. And if we don't, by scheduling these threads with our scheduler, we maintain the illusion that you have multiple cores and they kind of run in parallel simultaneously, just like multiple processes do. But unlike processes, they share all this data up here. And these threads, we're going to have to keep some thread state. And so we talked about process control procs, what's struct proc'd in XV6. And if we have threads that are different than processes, we're going to have a thread control block where we need to keep the registers for each thread, the context. And that's separate from everything that's common to the whole process, like the open files are shared between all the threads, the address space is shared between all the threads, like all the global variables are shared. The process ID is shared between all the threads, so that's separate from the process control block. So the traditional organization is you have a process control block, which contains a list of thread control blocks. The thread control block contains everything that's specific to threads, which is basically just the registers, including the program counter, and everything else is in the process control block. So there's another strategy out there. So Linux has a single task structure, which represents a thread, and it has pointers to something representing the address space, the list of open files, and its notion is just that they can be shared between threads. So a multi-threaded process is just a bunch of threads which have the same address space and list of open files pointer on Linux. But it achieves the same effect as if you had a process control block that's separate from the thread control block. You just have a thread control block with pointers to the process stuff that's the same for multiple threads. Now in Linux, when you start a thread, there's this fork-like system called clone, where you just say, I want to make a fork, but I want to actually share the list of open files. So I want it to be the case that if I close a file in the child I forked, it's closed in the parent too. And you can also say, I want to share the address space. So if I malloc something in the child, it's malloced in the parent too. And the advantage and why this model is common is that there's no special logic for threads, basically. But both things are used in real OSs. So in both these cases, we're talking about threads where there's some data structure in the kernel which represents a thread, that the kernel knows what threads are, and the OS scheduler is scheduling threads, not processes. And that's really what the scheduling decision is about. And that means that all our things about virtual time will deal with the virtual time of a thread, not a process, and so on. Everything is all about threads. This is not the only model that's out there. So there's this alternate idea where we schedule processes, and the processes schedule their threads themselves, that there's two schedulers, one within the kernel that schedules different users, and one which schedules within a process different threads. This is pretty uncommon, mostly because it's really tricky to make multi-core work well in this model. Because we want to have your one multi-threaded program running on multiple cores. If you have your own scheduler, we somehow have to have multiple copies of that scheduler. That's very tricky to make work. So typically we just have one scheduler that schedules threads in the kernel, and it schedules threads across all the programs that are running. So with that aside, let's talk about the first question, which is, why would we ever use threads? And you might say, well, you know, I hear about using threads all the time. It seems like an obviously useful thing. I'm going to assert you want to justify using threads because it's going to turn out using threads is pretty painful. And there's two basic reasons we're going to deal with. One is concurrency, that we're doing different things at once. Like we have multiple users of our web server, we're going to have like one thread to talk to each user, because those are kind of semi-independent tasks that we want to do in the same program. You know, or one thread for page in our web browser, those are semi-independent tasks we want to do at the same time. We don't want to have them wait for each other. And they're sort of their own program, but they need to share some state, so they should be in the same process. So that's sort of a justification for threads. Another justification, which is very different, which is parallelism, where I have some single task I want to do, but I want to take advantage of all my cores to do it. I want to do it faster with more CPU cores. And this is different than the concurrency thing, because typically all our threads will do the same thing, but different parts of it. And these are our big use cases for threads. So let's look at the API on POSIX for creating threads. First, questions on any of these basic use cases. We'll obviously come back to examples of threads later on, which would be more specific. Okay. So let's look at the API for creating threads. So POSIX threads are pthreads, P for POSIX. I don't have the header file here. They're all in the header file pthread.h. They all have man pages and other documentation that we will link from the relevant assignments. So here, I have a compute pi and print class list function. I'm going to run both at the same time. They're independent tasks. I'm not going to spawn subprocesses. So I create a pthread t, which is my thread ID. You should think of it like a PID, but for threads. Unlike a PID, it's not necessarily a number. So you can't print it out like a number, but it's like a PID otherwise. And I call pthread create. I pass some options here. I pass this function to run. Note that our function returns a void star and takes a void star. This is to allow us to pass things to and from threads with and be flexible about it. I run, create both these threads. So our first thing, that's our thread identifier. So that's our thread ID. This is how we'll wait for threads, for example. We have our function to run. So the thread starts there, instead of starting at main, starts at that function, and when that function returns, the thread exits. And we have this first null is thread attributes, which are extra settings for our threads. They're null in this case because I don't have any extra settings to set. And the argument to the function, which is also null, so the argument to the function is what's this void star argument will be. In this case, I'm passing null to both of them. But I could have passed something more useful if I had something to pass. Okay, so questions on this code? Yeah?
Wait, so the first null is arguments to the function?
The first null are extra attributes for the thread, like extra settings for the thread, and the second one is arguments to the function. I'll have an example later on of passing arguments to the function. Because that's a very important topic, obviously. If you want to run threads, you want to pass things to the threads. So I'll give some examples of that. Okay, so here I have a program where I start a thread. The thread, I have this print message function, which prints f in the thread, then returns null. And I created that thread. And when I run this program, run it a lot of times, and about 4% of the time it printed in the thread, the rest of the time it didn't. What happened? I'm starting this new thread, which is supposed to just print in the thread, and at the same time, my initial thread continues running. Yeah?
I guess the time spent making the thread, or the starting and executing the thread, during that time,
that
main returns.
Yeah, so main returned, and when main returns, our process exits. You would think just the thread running main exits. That would make sense, but that's not what happens. So returning from main exits the process. So we start this new thread. You know, we run printf, we do pthread create, we run printf, we return, and when we create, we start this new thread, it gets running, main returns, and that exits the entire process, all the threads. And depending on where this yellow strip lines up, 4% of the time, it ended up that it was, that you know, it was ended fast enough that it actually got to print out. But the rest of the time, it looked like this, where it was starting the printf and ran out of time. So there are two solutions for this. So one thing is we need the equivalent of wait PID. We want to wait for the thread to finish. And the equivalent of wait PID is called pthread join. So it takes the thread ID, and it takes a pointer, which is where to put the return value. I can pass null, in which case we just won't store the return value anywhere because I don't care about it. But if you wanted the return value, that's where you can get it. Just like with wait PID, you can pass a pointer and get the exit status. So that'll work. And this is probably what you typically should do. There's an alternate solution, which is you might say, it's silly that returning from main exits the entire process. Is there a way of just exiting the thread that's running main, but not the entire process? And the answer is yes, there is. There's a function called pthreadExit, which does that. So that just exits a thread rather than an entire process. Yes?
Does it waiting on the other thread defeat the purpose of having multiple threads?
So the question is, doesn't waiting on the other thread defeat the purpose of having multiple threads? So it depends what you think the purpose was. So if we go back to our list of possible purposes, one of them is that we just have different things happening at once. In which case, the purpose might just be that we wanted to write different code for what the thread's doing than main for our convenience. In which case, it's not really a problem. If you actually care about having things happen at the same time, maybe. Note that in this case, at least done starting thread is printed out at the same time the thread is running. Like those can happen in any order, they're actually independent. So we do get some advantage. Though this is an example where we're not actually computing anything, so it's hard to say like whether we're really taking advantage of threads correctly or not. So we have pthread join and pthread exit. So pthread exit is exactly the same as returning from the thread function in a thread we create with pthread create. Main doesn't work that way, because main is special. So we need to call it explicitly. Okay, so I mentioned that I would show you an example of passing things to threads. So here is one. So I have a thread function where I have an array, I'm creating two threads, and I'm doing the parallelism thing where I'm processing half the array in one thread, half the array in the other thread, and I wrote one function to handle that for both of the threads. So I want this one function to do the first half of the array sometimes, the second half other times, depending which thread I'm running. So a way I can do this is I cast an int to avoid star and cast it back, to get the ID of the thread, which is either 0 or 1, and then I use that to figure out what array indices I actually use. And yes, I know this is ugly, because we're passing things through void stars. Questions on this? Yeah.
On the previous slide, it says it's not recommended to use pthreadExit.
It's not recommended to use pthreadExit for main. Usually, you probably want to wait. It depends on the context, but pthreadExit for main is. Usually you have something you want your program to do before. You want your program to like decide when it exits, right? Is why I'm saying I don't recommend that. Usually have some reason way you know you're done. And you should have main exit then, is my idea. Other questions? So this is here, I fixed the number of threads. I could also not fix the number of threads and just have some variable telling me how many and still pass an ID number and just compute dynamically based on the number of threads what part of the array to use. So now I can handle 2 or 4 or so on, 10 threads with the same code. You may notice that I didn't precisely handle the end case for numbers of threads that don't evenly divide up 1,000. Yes.
What again is the value passed into
void
star?
What's the value?
Yeah, what is passed into
the thread? So this here is I. So I just cast I to a pointer, just because I needed to store I in this argument here.
Okay. So is that like the starting index?
So here, it's just the index of the thread, yes. Sorry, it's index of the thread, which we use to compute the starting index with this statement here.
Oh.
And that's a common pattern. You could also have passed the starting index and computed it in the function which starts the threads. So other questions on this code? Yes?
Why wouldn't you just make a thread for every item in the list?
So the question is, why wouldn't you just make a thread for every item in a list? So what happens when we create a thread? So we talked about thread control blocks. So what do you think we need to do to create a thread? Sorry? Yeah, so we have this process of making a thread, which at a minimum involves a system call. Because we need to tell the OS to add something to the list of runnable threads and run it. So, and it turns out there's going to be other costs. So one cost we can think of is, well, each thread has a stack for it where it's calling, so we need to allocate a stack for every thread. So making a thread for each item, probably too expensive. Also, if we have lots of threads, we have more context switches, and that's going to be more expensive. Yes?
What's a void star exactly?
So the question is, what is a void star? A void star is a type which can represent a pointer to anything. In this case, I'm kind of cheating and using the pointer to store, converting an integer to a pointer and back, and relying on that not breaking. Yes?
How do you access which process is running on which thread?
How do I access which process is running on which thread? So you mean I'm running in my process, I want to know which of my threads are running now? The answer basically is you can't. That as far as you're concerned, especially with pthreads, you start the threads and they're running whenever they get scheduled. The only way you can tell is based on the effects of their code. Like there's not generally a way to peek at what the scheduler is doing precisely. Like there are like non-programmer interfaces for that. Like if you, who's here has seen TOP? Nope, okay. Some people. You've seen PS. So like PS can give you a snapshot sometimes of what's running, but only when PS is running, which may not be useful. So you can get the information that way, but like it's not very precise, usually. Like obviously there's features in, for like debugging which will tell you exactly when things run, but the notion basically is that you should not depend on what gets run when, or else your code is wrong, because you don't know what the scheduler's priorities are. So this idea of passing a thread idea, this is a common pattern when I have a bunch of threads I need to start. Another thing you could do is you could like make a class with info about what the thread's supposed to do, make a new one for each thread, and pass a pointer to it as that argument. And void star is a type which can hold any kind of pointer, so I just take my pointer, convert it to a void star, my thread info pointer, and convert it back. And note that since I allocated it with new, I need to delete it when I'm done. Yeah?
So, to make this happen, like, you would need to know something about how many cores or whatever you have.
So the question is, how do I set numthreads? So any number, pretty assuming you don't like run out of space, will work. The correct number depends on a lot of things. So if you want to just use all the CPU, you want your number of threads to basically be equal to the number of cores, assuming you're just doing computation. If you're doing I/O, you might actually want more threads. Because like if you're reading from the network and you want to use all your cores, you need extra threads to deal with when your thread is waiting. So you might want more than that. And you might choose the number of threads based on what's most convenient to program rather than what's actually most efficient. It's pretty common. So for example, in a web browser, you might have a thread for each page. That's not because that is the most efficient number of threads to run. That's because it's a lot easier to program a thread, the code for a thread that handles one page, than code which handles some arbitrary number of pages. Yeah?
When people write applications, do they really think about this? Or are there like levels of abstraction that developers use?
The question is, when you're writing applications, do you really think about this? Often, you think about how things are divided into threads. There are abstractions, especially for particular kinds of applications. So like there are libraries for writing network servers, which might abstract a bunch of this stuff away. But it is actually pretty common that if you're writing an application, you'll have to deal with what you create threads for. Yeah?
What is that end parameter used for?
The which parameter?
The parameter of run threads.
Which parameter?
The parameter, sorry.
It is not used. It's meant to be num threads. I meant to have it be num threads and not n.
Okay.
I mean, because actually it could be used in the dot 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 part. Or like passed as an argument to thread info. It's a constructor. Okay. Other questions about this? Okay, so here's some code. Now what's wrong with this? Oh, and I might have the wrong use of pthread join. I definitely have the wrong use of pthread join. Well, how about that? So let's make this correct like I intended it to be. So I have string pointer, and we have a string pointer here, and we do pthread join the thread, and a pointer to the string pointer. I believe that is actually the syntax. Sorry. I, for some reason, forgot how pthread join worked when I made this thing. And I will definitely correct that. So we have string pointer here, and we just fill in the string pointer. Why can't we do that? So we have this thread. It returns a pointer to a string. Yeah.
The thread had its own stack.
Thread had its own stack. So what we're doing here is is that our string result is here. And that goes away when the thread is joined. Yeah. Yeah, so the mount points to something that's free. So these thread stacks are typically allocated with something like malloc, in fact. So it's exactly a pointer to freed memory. So something you note here is that we're saying that threads have stacks that are allocated. So that's one of the costs of making lots of threads. In addition to more context switches and more copies of like all the registers, each of them has a stack. You might wonder, how big is that stack? It varies. So when we create a thread, we're allocating a new stack of some size, a thread control block. We need to make a system call because the thread control block is in the kernel. And pthread's policy is that if you don't join, things aren't going to be deallocated. That if you don't collect the return values, things aren't deallocated. Just like with processes, they're kept around for wait PID, threads are going to be kept around for join. There is a way of avoiding this, which is something called pthread detach. So pthread detach says, I don't care about knowing when this thread finishes. I'm not going to join it. I don't care about its return value. Just deal with it. Just clean it up when it's done. So questions about this? And here I have the example of a show progress thread. We don't care about that finishing, so I would just spawn it, don't have to join it, don't have to wait for it to finish. We can also use that argument that I haven't shown you to start threads as detached. The API is kind of ugly, but there's this pthread attribute structure that you can fill in with a bunch of functions. And one of the ways you can fill it in is you can say, this thread starts as detached. So I also told you, how much space do we allocate from the stack? And you're used to, like, the stack is all the memory. That's not going to really work when we have threads, especially if we want to spawn 1,000 threads, as you proposed earlier. So how much space do we allocate? It varies. There's a default setting, which is often pretty high. You can set that explicitly with that attribute struct, too. So here I'm saying, I want this thread to be started with 32 kilobytes of stack. So questions on this? Yeah.
Can you go back to the slide where it's the code that returns the string?
Yeah.
So if you can return
You can return the. I have this in pthread join takes a pointer to where to put the return value. I, for some reason, thought it returned the value. So the syntax, if I can write this more clearly, is pthread underscore join the thread ID and where, and this basically will do star where equals the red val.
And so that where will give us the.
So star where would be set to and percent results.
Okay.
In this case. Yeah, I will have a corrected version of this slide next time. I can't believe I missed this when I was reviewing my slides. Yeah. Yeah, this would be something that main would set. So in this case, where would be at string pointer.
And then it's deallocated once the.
So the usage would be that here in this code we have string star where, and we do that, and then this says set star where equal to result, and so we could see out star where and get the string is and try to print it out, but we'd be printing out something from a bogus stack. So it takes the prototype to make it maybe clearer is that it's pthread join of pthread underscore t, so the thread ID, and a void star star, which is corresponds to this return type. Does that make more sense? Yeah, and I'm sorry for, I'll have a corrected version of that slide next time. Okay, so one last note on the pthread API. So first of all, there are man pages. So all these things have a manual page. There's also, and I believe in the assignment, first assignment between pthreads, we have a link. There's the official POSIX documentation is online and basically looks like man pages. It is relatively readable. And in the man page, one of the things is errors. So pthread create returns an integer. The integer is the error that occurred. So it's zero if there's no error, otherwise it's an error number. Unlike fork, it doesn't say error no. It's not like fork, wait, PID, and so on. These work differently. They return the error number instead of setting error no. Because they decided, wait, having global variables for threads maybe doesn't make, thread errors doesn't make sense. So this is the pattern for pthreads functions. And on most of my slides, I will not include error checking code. That doesn't mean you shouldn't include error checking code. But I won't, just to keep things simple. So you should like actually do something about it. Just like you check and fork, you want to check pthread create, you might fail, like for example, if you're out of space to allocate the stack. So next time we'll talk about synchronizing between threads and review the pthread API.